Okay, before I get started, where's the lady from New York who's having a birthday today? Happy birthday! I can't believe you came from New York. Are you insane? It's not gonna be that good. I'm just telling you right now. I'm getting older, you know, it's just not. Wait a second, I have this written down though. First of all, I'm delighted to be at Thurber House again. I have that written down, but it's true. I mean, it sounds like, well, I'm so delighted to hear, you know. No, I really am. I used to be a docent here. I was the worst docent in the history of Thurber House. it was such a cute little house that I wanted to come here, so I volunteered to be a docent. And I do like Thurber, but I'm a 19th century British. So they come up and ask me questions about Thurber, and I go, have you read The 13 Clocks? Because it's fabulous. So I wasn't a docent very long. They actually expect you to know things. Louder? Can't you listen harder? So I like to tailor my speeches to audiences, but I figure what people really are interested in is stuff nobody else knows. So I'm not going to talk about Wild Ride, which is out in March 16th. Which is far enough off, because frankly, I finished it, it's done, I'm not interested in it anymore. We do have the cover for it. So I feel like I have now, see the cover? Everyone has seen the cover? I've done my bit for Wild Ride. It's about demons in Southern Ohio, everything. And those of you who live in Southern Ohio know that's realism. So people have been asking some questions, and I'll just take a little tiptoe through my career here. First, I started with Harlequin. Which many people thought, I was actually a PhD candidate at the time, so it was a stretch. But people like Sarah Garnes were wonderful and supported me and terrific. People at Ohio State were great. And then I got mad at Harlequin and left because they were being ridiculous. And I did two books for Bantam, which will be reissued next year. If anybody here liked the Bantam books, they're coming out again. You wait long enough, they bring everything out. And then I went to St. Martin's Press where I did, I can't remember now, six romance novels. All solo. And then I started doing collaborations. I've done 5 collaborations since then. And usually, somebody always comes up to me and says, so, you wrote 15 romance novels, and then you went to collaborations. Why did you do that? I hate your collaborations. If you're one of those people, just keep it to yourself. I have enough stress. But what happened was I went through menopause. Now, if you have not gone through menopause, or will never go through menopause, don't judge. Because your brains just go out your ears. And what happened was, people laugh at this, but it's actually true. When I'm writing stories, I write down the voices in my head. You know, you kind of go into that alter, you hear the stories, you write them down. The voices went away. And it's hard to explain that to New York. Why can't you write another Bette Midler? The voices aren't there anymore. So I was having a nervous breakdown at the Maui Writers Conference, which is a wonderful place to have a nervous breakdown, because if you're the faculty, they work you horribly from like 8 in the morning until 6 at night. But at 6 at night, they open the faculty lounge, which is free food and free booze. So you're in there with fabulous writers, and you're getting drunk on your butt until 2 o'clock in the morning, and then you stagger out the next morning and teach again and lather, rinse, repeat for 2 weeks. And someplace in there, and I was probably under the weather, so to speak. This guy came up to me and said, handed me a glass of white wine, so immediately I loved him, and said, we should collaborate. And somewhere in there I said yes. And it turned out to be a really good deal. That was Bob Mayer. He's a Green Beret from the Bronx, and we wrote 3 books together. And that's it. We're still going never say never, but basically, you know that whole, if you know the shtick, it's I was an English teacher from Ohio, he was a Green Beret from the Bronx. How could they ever work together? They can't. He's in Seattle. We finally got to the point where he said, we'll be okay if we're never in the same zip code. So he's in Seattle, I'm here in Ohio, and after the last one I said, you know, I think I'm ready to write solos again. I love my collaborations, I learned so much from the collaborations, but this book was pushing at me and I thought, this is just, I want my books back. Collaborating, you have to reach for the other person, and it makes you go outside your comfort zone, and you learn so much. I am so grateful to my collaborators, and I will probably collaborate again because it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. But all of a sudden, I'm feeling greedy. I want the whole book. And the book I've been working on, now that I got rid of Bob and the demons, there are demons in that book, and that was fun. I'd never gone there before, but it set me up for this one because what I wanted to do was write my version of Turn of the Screw. Now, this is not because I think Henry James did not do a good job on Dirt of the Screw. I think it's a magnificent piece of literature. And I've loved it. I've taught it at the college level. I've taught it in high school. Go back to it over and over again. It's just, it's the most amazing piece of characterization and the building of the atmosphere. And it's just brilliant. But there were things in it that I always stopped and thought, you know, if I was doing this, that wouldn't happen. This would happen. And there's something that when you start a book, if you've written novels, you know that it's hell. I mean, it doesn't look like hell because you're not wearing pantyhose and you're sitting around drinking Diet Coke. You know, it seems like a good deal. You don't have to get up till you're ready, but it's an incredible drain, and you're putting everything you have into this book. And so every time I finish one, I think that's the last one, except I really, just this one more story. They're like peanuts, you know, just one more. And for some reason, this time, I've been thinking about this for years, but Turn of the Screw turned up this time, and I thought, this time I'm really going to do it. The problem is, if you take Turn of the Screw, which was written in 1898, and move it to 2010, things change. Most particularly, women have changed. So I knew that I was essentially, if I started with Turn of the Screw and started to do my play on it, unless I was just going to do a parody or a pastiche of the plot, which frankly, anybody can do, and isn't that interesting. What I was basically doing was going to be ripping the heart out of James's novel, because it's about this 20-year-old, incredibly innocent 20-year-old, who goes to this house in the country and has total domain over this home, but encounters these very smart ghosts. And there's a lot of debate over whether the ghosts are there or not, but whether she's crazy and thinks there are ghosts or whether the ghosts are really real, her struggle is real. The heart of James' novel then is about this woman in isolation and how she goes mad because she cannot connect, at least to me. You know, there are people out there, James scholars, going, no, that's not what it's about. Yes, it is. I have the microphone. That's what it's about. But if I put a 20th century or 21st century woman in that situation, things were going to be very, very different. What I was really worried about was that having ripped the themes out of Turn of the Screw, that there wouldn't be anything there, that when I started to do my version, it would just be this pale copy, and not very good, because let's face it, it's a masterpiece. But as I began to write it, I first began writing it just as the pastiche. Here's the first scene. Here's my version of that first scene, which was interesting, just as a writing exercise, it's fabulous. If those of you who are writers in the audience, take your favorite book, take the first chapter, especially if it's a 19th century novel, take the first scene and rewrite it as if it's in the 20th century, and what you learn about your own taste and what's happened, and it was fascinating to do. But what I was really worried about as I wrote it, it was a lot of fun. I was having tremendous fun with this book, but I kept thinking there's not going to be any there. When I get finished, it's just going to be cute. I don't want to do cute, you know? I want something that's going to resonate. But I forgot that stories fill from behind. And as I wrote through here, even on the scenes that I pulled directly from James and rewrote, they fed into my own theme, that I had issues here, that things were going to happen. And I'm going to read a little bit of James, and then I begin apologizing to James Purist. I cut some of it. He's wordy. And then I'll read my version of it. So you will be the first people to ever hear the first, especially this version, of the first scene of Always Kiss Me Goodnight. The title, by the way, comes from those horrible plaques that are sold everywhere. Every time I look at those, I think, ew! Can you imagine somebody coming going, Always Kiss Me Goodnight? I'm thinking, no. So there was something in that, you know, maybe not. Other people seem to, they're very popular. You can find them everywhere. And by the way, those of you who wish to give me gifts, do not give me one of those, because I have like 12 now. Everybody knows, here, I got you this. Thanks. I don't need any more. So the Turn of the Screw begins. James does this thing with a double frame. He begins with the narrator, who is James, who then talks about his friend Douglas, who is narrating a story, who then reads the diary of the governess. So you have the James frame, the narrator frame, and the governess. The first time I read this, I thought this is fascinating. How's he going to get out of this double frame? If you've read the Turn of the Screw, no, he doesn't. He just ends the book. I love this book, but that's the one place where if I met Henry James, I would say, Henry, we need to talk. This is not the way you, but it seems to have lasted even though the frame wasn't there, so I'm going to let it go. So it begins, James says he's at this party, and he's with his friend Douglas. Now, you know how when you read, you attach or don't attach to characters? Douglas is not my favorite. Douglas is, let's face it, a twit. But James really likes him, so he invests a lot in him. And he says they're at this house party, and one of the guests named Griffin tells the story about this little boy who sees a ghost in the middle of the night, and he screams, and he wakes up his mother, and his mother says, it's all right, and then she looks up, and she sees the ghost, too. This evidently chills the blood of everybody at the house party, so you just have to run with that. You know, I think we're just jaded. We have Supernatural, we have all these horror, you know, after Jason and Freddy, you know, a ghost standing there is just not, but for James, this was horrifying. And then Douglas comes in, and Douglas is evidently one of those people who says, well, that was very interesting. Now, let me tell you a really good story, because what Douglas says is, I quite agree in regard to Griffin's ghost, or whatever it was. That's when I started to dislike him. That it's appearing first to the little boy at so tender an age adds a particular touch. But it's not the first occurrence of its charming kind that I know to have involved a child. If the child gives the effect of another turn of the screw, if it makes the ghost story that much worse, what do you say to two children? And at that point you think, Douglas, you know, I'm going to go over here. I don't care if it was two children. She's so obviously one-upping Griffin. And everybody says, oh, well, that's really excited. That gives two turns of the screw. So he says, well, this didn't happen to me. It happened to a friend of mine who's a governess, and I will send to town to get her diary, which she sent me. This was the second time I didn't like Douglas. Here's my diary I entrusted to you, so he's going to read it to a house party. Not my kind of guy. But he says, it's in old faded ink and in the most beautiful hand, a woman's. She's been dead these 20 years. She sent me the pages and questions before she died. They were all listening now, and of course there was somebody to be arch, or at any rate to draw the inferences. I'm thinking, yes, of course they are. I've known her 20 years. She sent me her diary. Obviously, there was something going on there. But if Douglas put the inference by without a smile, it was also without irritation. She was a most charming person, but she was 10 years older than I. How many in here think Douglas, who's writing off a woman who's 10 years older than he is kind of a twit? Never mind, I'll just go with that. So of course I could have no interest in her. She was my sister's governess. She was the most agreeable woman I've ever known in her position. She would have been worthy of any position whatever. Oh yes, don't grin. I liked her extremely, and I'm glad to think this day she liked me too. If she hadn't, she wouldn't have told me this story. She had never told anyone. And James says, because the thing had been such a scare, he continued to fix me. You will easily judge. You will. The rest of them are idiots, but you will. I fixed him too. I see. She was in love. He laughed for the first time. You are acute. Yes, she was in love. That is, she had been. That came out. She couldn't tell her story without its coming out. I saw it and she saw I saw it, but neither of us spoke of it. Yeah. What is it about men and communication? Why didn't he say, so, tell me about this guy? So James sets this up, and it's going to be a love story, this governess, and of course it's going to be a horrible love story because, apologies to everyone of the male gender, a guy wrote it. Have you ever noticed when men write love stories, somebody dies at the end? My theory is the commitment is not a fantasy for guys. Found the perfect woman. Just let me sail into this storm and throw this bottle in the water. I'll be right back. So I knew what was coming here. So Mrs. Griffin, that would be the wife of the person he has just one-upped, expressed the need for a little more light. Who was it she was in love with? James says, the story will tell. Mrs. Griffin says, oh, I can't wait for the story. And Douglas says, the story won't tell. Not in any literal, vulgar way. Okay, I make my living with the literal, vulgar way, so I don't care for Douglas. But I love Mrs. Griffin because she says, more's the pity, then. That's the only way I ever understand. She's my reader. So it goes on, and James gives the setup, and it's the perfect gothic setup. Now, I can do 4 hours on gothic novels, but I won't, so relax. But the basic gothic novel, beginning with Jane Eyre, but really solidifying in the 60s and 70s. Remember the books with the girl in the nightgown? She was 17, she's running around screaming, and there's a big house in the background? It's the same setup. There's an extremely young, innocent girl who comes to be governess to these children in the middle of nowhere. The house is always in the wilderness, and I could explain to you symbolically why, but time is short. Huge house, male authority figure who owns the house and who dominates her, and she comes of age because she transfers the fact that she is a child to the children. She has to grow up to protect the children, and at the end, she marries the master of the house, which means she now owns the house, and she has a similar, she has the kids, she has the husband, she has the house, but the important thing here is the house. In the 70s in publishing, they used to call these books Girl Gets House books. Now, it wasn't that it was real estate. It was that controlling that house meant controlling her environment, that she was establishing her own world. So the house is huge. It's always been huge. Look at the fall of the House of Usher or A Rose for Emily, where the house is an extension of the people living there. So once we've got this, now there's this governess, she was in love. How about the setup? And James gives you the perfect Gothic setup. The governess was the youngest of several daughters of a poor country parson who, at the age of 20, on taking service for the first time in the schoolroom, came up to London in trepidation to answer in person an advertisement that had placed her in brief correspondence with the Advertiser. This person proved on presenting herself for judgment at a house in Harley Street that impressed her as vast and imposing. As soon as you see that house, you got a hero somewhere in there. This prospective patron proved a gentleman, a bachelor in the prime of life, such a figure as had never risen save in a dream or an old novel. So James knows exactly what he's doing. You know, he's setting up a Gothic here. One could easily fix this type of man. It never happily dies out. He was handsome and bold and pleasant, offhand and gay and kind. He struck her inevitably as gallant and splendid. But what took her most of all and gave her the courage she afterwards showed was that he put the whole thing to her as a kind of favor, an obligation he should gratefully incur. She conceived of him as rich but fearfully extravagant, saw him in all the glow of high fashion, of good looks, of expensive habits, of charming ways with women. He's a romance hero. And then he had for his town residence a big house filled with spoils of travel and trophies of the chase, but it was to his country home, an old family place in Essex, that he wished her immediately to proceed. Two houses. This guy's a keeper. And then the situation. He was left by the death of their parents in India, guardian to a small nephew and niece. These children were, by the strangest chances for a man in his position, a lone man without the right sort of experience or gram of patience, very heavily on his hands. It had been a great worry, a series of blunders, but he immensely pitied the poor chicks and had done all he could, had in particular sent them down to his country house, parting even with his own servants to wait on them and going down himself whenever he might to see how they were doing. It's that whenever he might. You know, he, you know, dashed by once on the way to the hounds or something. He had put them in possession of Bly, which was healthy and secure, and had placed at the head of their establishment an excellent woman, Mrs. Gross, who had been maid to his mother. There had been for the two children at first a young lady whom they had the misfortune to lose. She had done for them quite beautifully. She was a most respectful person till her death, the great awkwardness of which had left no alternative but school for little Miles and Mrs. Gross for Flora. So far had Douglas presented his picture when somebody put a question, what did the former governess die of? So much respectability? And our friend's answer was prompt, that will come out. Douglas, you cannot tell a story. You know, if you're going to set that going, you have to give. So James steps in and says, I should have wished to learn if the office brought with it necessary danger to life. Douglas completed my thought. She did wish to learn, and she did learn. You shall hear tomorrow night what she learned. I'm thinking, she was young, untried. Meanwhile, of course, the prospect struck her as slightly grim. She was young, untried, nervous. It was a vision of serious duties, yada, yada, yada. But in the end, she said yes. And Douglas, with this, made a pause that, for the benefit of the company, moved me to throw in, the moral of which was, of course, the seduction exercised by the splendid young man. She succumbed to it. He got up as he had done the night before, went to the fire, and then stood a moment with his back to us. She only saw him twice. That's where I thought, you made me a promise here. This was going to be a Gothic. Actually, I love this book so much, I never thought that. But, you know, follow with me. And then James says, yes, but that's just the beauty of her passion that she only saw him twice. I refer you again, men and their love stories. A little to my surprise on this, Douglas turned around on me. It was the beauty of it. There were others who hadn't succumbed. He told her frankly all his difficulty. There were some simply afraid. It sounded dull, it sounded strange, and all the more because of his main condition. This was the point at which I said, someday I'm going to write this story and fix this, which was that she should never trouble him. But never, never, neither appeal nor complain nor write about anything, only meet with all questions herself, receive all monies from his solicitor, take the whole thing over, and let him alone. She promised to do this. And mentioned to me that when for a moment, disburdened, delighted, he held her hand, thanking her for her sacrifice, she already felt rewarded. Now, we must give the governess a little credit because she's going to pay for that one. One of the ladies asked, but was that all her reward? Douglas says she never saw him again. Oh, said the lady. Yeah, I said oh, too. Now, the thing is, what he is setting up here, it's really brilliant that he's setting up this Gothic romance and then turning it on its head, because it's actually a Gothic romance. The more I read this and the more I looked at the character of the governess, which is fascinating, the more I realized that the last thing in the world the governess wanted was that guy in that country house. If she's there alone for the first time in her life, she has the house. It's really girl gets house. She has the kids, she has complete control, she has these wonderful dreams of this fabulous hero without ever actually having to pick up his socks or do anything else that maybe as a 20-year-old virgin she doesn't want to do. So I could see why she went for this straight and came down and walked straight into this nightmare that's at Bly. It's a fabulous story, and there's so many other parts of it that I love that I'm not going to read to you tonight because time is passing by. But when I decided to do this, I thought the thing I'm going to try is this first scene. And I had actually, that first scene made such an impact on me, I literally thought it was a scene. I thought it had been part of the governess's diary. So I was stunned to find out that Douglas had related it, and it had still grabbed me so strongly. So this is the current version. It will change many times before I get this finished, but this is the current version of my first scene, of that scene where the governess meets the guy who wants the house she wants to get. "Mr. Archer will see you now," the little secretary said, and Emmeline said, "Well, good for him." She stood up and put the Sotheby's catalog back on the heavy wood table beside the huge leather sofa, took a deep breath, and walked to the office door. North sat behind his massive desk, frowning at some paper through his wire-rimmed glasses. Sunlight from the big paned windows glinting on his fair hair. He looked intense, intelligent, and incredibly well-bred, but he didn't look at her. "Mr. Archer," the secretary said, "Miss Miller is here." He raised his head and met Emmy's eyes and grew even more still. He was older now. There were lines, and his forehead was definitely higher, but he still had that look of polite disinterest that had once driven her crazy. "Emmeline," he said, "it was good of you to come." "I'd say it was good of you to ask me, but I'm going to reserve that till I see what you want," Emmy said. She crossed the carpet, trying not to trip or clomp or do anything else that would once again betray her low origins in the middle class. "Thank you," Kristen North said, and the secretary nodded twice and backed out as Emmy sat down. Then she came back in. "Do you want coffee, Mr. Archer? Miss Miller?" "She doesn't drink coffee," North said, and Emmy thought about saying, "Yes, I do," just to annoy him. She could have changed in 10 years. She crossed her legs instead. North had always been a leg man, but he was looking at the secretary. "Thank you, Kristen," he said firmly. "Oh," Kristen flashed a nervous smile. "Okay." "She's got to be new," Emmy said as the door closed. "She is," North said, "but she's intelligent and efficient, and she does what I tell her to." He left unsaid, "unlike you." "Up yours," Emmy thought. "So what's this about?" "I have a problem," North said, smooth again behind his 2-ton desk. "A lot of really heavy trees had died to make that desk. His mother had probably gnawed them down and then used her nails to saw." "Emmeline, are you listening to me?" "Every word, North. You have a problem. Let me guess. Southie?" "Sanford is fine," North said with an undercurrent to his voice that said, "back off. He's taken over the Archer Trust and is doing a splendid job." "Now, about you gave Southie the keys to the trust?" Emmy narrowed her eyes. "No, you didn't. Who's got veto power over him?" She saw his nostrils flare and braced herself for the put down, but then he said, "Mother is helping." And her laughter spurted out before she could stop it. "So Lydia is running the trust. Now I believe it. You have them checkmating each other. Very efficient. You haven't changed at all." "Thank you," North said. "I could say the same about you, but that would be a personal comment in the context of a professional discussion, and so it would be rude and inappropriate." Emmy smiled at him brightly. "Miss me?" He was still again for a long moment, and her smile faded. "I have a job for you," he said, "and I will consider it a personal favor should you accept it." Emmy blinked at him. North didn't ask for favors. "I will pay you $10,000 a month, all expenses paid, including room and board, if in return you will execute this commission without disrupting my work or my life." "Gee," Emmy said, "sounds like old times." But she thought $10,000 a month, that was a lot of money, even more than a lot of money in this economy, even more because she was sinking fast in this economy. And North asking a personal favor, what's the catch? "There is no catch," he said, exasperation creeping into his voice. "I don't see the reason for suspicion. Have I ever asked you for anything before?" "A divorce." "I did not ask you for a divorce. You told me that I seemed unhappy, and if that was true, you would understand if I divorced you." "Exactly," North frowned at her. Emmy drew a deep breath. "There are people who, if their spouses are unhappy, do something about it." North said, "I did. I gave you a divorce." "Could we return to the subject at hand?" "Sure," Emmy said. "$10,000 a month. Who do I have to kill?" "He's already dead. My second cousin, Theodore Archer, died last spring." Emmy frowned. "I don't think I ever met him." "Neither did I," North said, "but he made me guardian of his children." "You never met, but..." And then she stopped and thought, "You have all the money in the family, pots of it. Never mind. Why do these kids have a guardian? Don't they have closer relatives?" Their mother died several years ago. They had one relative, their mother's sister, who cared for them at the family country home, Bly. The house has a name. Sorry, I cut a bunch of stuff here in a second. North ignored her. Unfortunately, their aunt died in January. I need somebody I trust to go to Bly, evaluate the situation, and do whatever needs to be done for the children. She died in January. It's March. Who's been taking care of? I hired three nannies, North said. They don't stay. The place is rural. So what I need? Well, who's with them now? There's a housekeeper, Mrs. Crum. She seems to be a very competent woman, but I can't assume that. What I need is someone whose opinion I trust to go to Essex, find out what the kids need, and set about providing that for them. You were a teacher, so... Emmy straightened a little bit at the were. Were? Sorry, North said. I'm sure you'll find employment again soon. But in the meantime, how do you find out these things? Emmy said, trying to keep the edge out of her voice. It was hardly a secret, North said, when you take on the head of the school board. I did not take on the head of the school board. I told him that I agreed with him that creationism had a place in the school curriculum. In the mythology class. North said, you could have been more tactful. Well, it sure as hell didn't belong in a science class, Emmy said. Well, possibly if you'd said that more tactfully. It wouldn't have helped, Emmy said. He already hated me. So about these kids. They sound young. I teach high school art. I know nothing about... No, they're 8 and 12. That's practically high school. Emmy looked to see if he was kidding. Not even close. Did you even get to know these kids? Their aunt was there. They didn't need a stranger in their lives. No, you didn't need two strangers in yours. Emmy saw his eyes narrowed and said, don't bother. You like your relationships tidy, logical, and distant. How could you know what kids need? Emmeline, this is not about me. This is business. So what about this business aren't you telling me? Three nannies have left in 8 weeks, and you're paying me $10,000 a month to go stay there, and I assume it's so bad that you're paying me to stick. North leaned back. You'll stick anyway. You'll go if I didn't pay you now that you know something needs fixed. He smiled at her, almost the old North. You were born to fix things. She fought off the instinct to soften. This is business, North. Let's keep our personalities out of it. If you knew I'd go, why are you overpaying me? Oh, wait, not the alimony thing again. I'm paying you for your services. This has nothing to do with the alimony you refused 10 years ago, ridiculous as that was. $10,000 a month for my services, Emmy said. For that, you should not only get child care, you should get your house cleaned, your plants watered, your laundry done, your tires rotated. And if I were you, I'd insist on nightly blowjobs. North sat very still, which meant he was gathering his patience. Then he drew a breath and said calmly, Emmeline, for once, would you just shut up and take the money? You've been out of work for 9 months. You need... It's too much, Emmy said. It's charity, and I was never interested in your money. Emmy, take the money. It's going to be difficult. The boy, there's something wrong. He's been setting fires, and there was something about a cat. Oh, great, Emmy said. A serial killer begins. He didn't kill his aunt, did he? North hesitated. You're kidding me, she said. There was an accident. She fell from one of the towers on the house. The house has towers? It's an old English country house. North took his glasses off and rubbed his hand across his eyes. Theodore's great-grandfather had it brought over from England in 1870. Evidently it has towers since May Younger fell from one. He put his glasses back on. And it has two children who have lost everyone they've ever known. Will you please go to Ohio and find out what they need and give it to them? Emmy could see the age on him now. He was still good-looking, but 40 years of being North Archer had taken its toll. Southie probably still looked smooth as a hard-boiled egg, but North, yes, she said, I'll do it for the room and board. No, you will not. I owe you this one, she said, standing up. I left you. I can do this. He stood, too. $10,000 a month is a small price for me to keep my obligations with no disruption to my life. If you're there, I'll know somebody's doing the right thing. That shouldn't have gotten to her, but it did. He'd found out she'd lost her job. He thought she'd do the right thing, and he remembered she didn't like coffee. It's a business proposition, Emmy, he said gently. You should be paid. She thought, and you want to give me the money. Well, she needed it. Pride would have to wait for solvency. Thank you, she said. I'll earn it. I have no doubt. The last nanny claimed the place was haunted. Probably the boy playing tricks on her. North straightened to signal that the meeting was over. Kristen has all the details for you. There's a household account you can draw on. The housekeeper will stay and cook for you. There's a man who takes care of the grounds who will drive you anywhere. The place is in the middle of a wilderness, and the roads are confusing and dangerous. Emmy nodded, feeling the old irritation that she was once more being dismissed efficiently and firmly, so North could get back to work. Fine. I'll go down tomorrow. You have a good spring terrorizing the opposing council. She headed for the door, refusing to look back. This was all good. She was going to get out of debt. She'd have time to work on a book. This was just business. Emmy, North said, and she turned back in the doorway. Thank you, he said. And for a moment, the facade was gone, and it was just North looking at her the way he used to. She swallowed. You're welcome. He nodded, and the facade was back. Please don't call me about this. Just handle everything. I'll handle everything unless there are ghosts, Emmy said. If there are ghosts, you're getting your ass to Bly. Then she turned and walked out before he could say anything else that was just business. Oh, thank you. I think you have to do that. Now, there are a lot of things that are awkward about that still that I have to fix. There's, you know, about his trying to get all these characters in and get the family in and all this stuff and all their background and everything. But the thing that I needed to get down on the paper was how this was going to be different from his, that I was going to have to do enough to echo it. And I think that's a pretty good echo of that first scene, enough that you can tie it to Turn of the Screw. But at the same time, how different this is. And at that point, I had to start looking at what that difference meant. Because as I said, if I'm just doing my version of Turn of the Screw, that's cheap and easy. There has to be something interesting here. Not just that the book has to stand on its own for people who have never read Turn of the Screw, because a lot of my readers won't have read Turn of the Screw. A lot of people haven't read Turn of the Screw. But also for people who have read both and love both, that there's something interesting in the tension between them. That when you see at the end where she says, you're getting your ass to Bly if there are ghosts, and you know that there will be ghosts because there were in Turn of the Screw, and that this is going to be a change. But one of the big differences I recognize is I do a lot of stuff with community. Community is incredibly important to me. And of course, here's James's governess, and she's out there all alone. The reason she fails, I think, there are a lot of reasons, but the big one is she's so isolated, so that when the ghosts show up, whether they're real ghosts or whether she's making them up, she's alone and she doesn't have anybody standing beside her, you know, giving her a sense of reality. She doesn't have anybody to talk to. She gets all caught up in the bubble of her own world. So her problem is because she's isolated. Emmy's problem is actually the opposite. She goes down there, she's very efficient, she's older, she's in her 30s, she handles everything. There are ghosts in this one, and the ghosts feed on the emotions, the energies from the people in the house. But when Emmy walks in, things get calmer. Takes her a little while, but she calms everything down, the kids are fine, she's doing okay, and so the ghosts are in abatement. They don't have any emotion to feed on. But almost immediately, people start showing up at the house. Bly turns into a clown car. Every time she opens the door, there's somebody else. So the first person who comes down is Southie, the younger brother, and he's there because his girlfriend, who is a TV reporter, not at all like Gail Hogan. Actually, if you swear never to tell anybody so I don't get sued, I'm basing her on Nancy Grace, and I've been watching those shows trying to pick up the cadence of her. She has the most fascinating cadence in her voice, and if I can just nail that, so I'm watching all this Nancy Grace, horrified, but still going, okay. And she has this flunky who's also her cameraman, because Nancy Grace has this guy who's always going, yeah, Nancy, and does the voiceovers, and I love him, because he's just, really, you have to watch Nancy Grace, it's fabulous. And she has managed, I have to talk with Gail about this because we have to figure out what way to get this TV crew down there, but she's brought her cameraman then who she's sleeping with, even though Southie doesn't know that because he thinks she's his girlfriend, and along the way she's also brought a parapsychologist. So all these people show up, and there's all kinds of emotion whirling there, and the ghosts get stronger, and then that night she does a remote from the house talking about these kids and how they've been abandoned here by North Archer, and North's mother sees the show. And she shows up on the front porch, and needless to say, Emmy and Lydia were not best friends forever. And then North finds out that Lydia's gone down there, so he follows him down, and then a medium shows up. Like, really, it's like a clown car. There are so many people, and there are so many cross currents, and there are so many conflicts, and the emotion builds and builds and builds, and the ghosts become incredibly powerful. If the governess hadn't been alone, she'd have won, I think. If Emmy had been left alone, she would have won. So there's an inversion there that I'm still not quite sure what it means, but I know it's going to pan out. The other thing, in the beginning when you're writing a book, you know, I was an English major, I always want to know the theme, but it's never what I think it's going to be, so I've stopped doing that. But you can't help as the book emerges looking for things, and I think one of the things that's also in this book, I'm guessing, don't hold me to this, is that sense of a do-over. My first agent told me that people love high school reunion stories because there's a sense that you can go back and do that again. You know, there's that second chance. And I thought, this book is full of ghosts. If anybody ever wanted, you know, there are people who haven't moved on after death because there's something unfinished. They want those do-overs. And obviously, Emmy and North are set up for a do-over. It's one of the problems of writing books that are either romances or have a strong romance subplot is that you know these two people are going to get together. You know, I'm not going to betray you in the end and have North fall from a tower or something. I'm not Henry James. But that there has to be something interesting in the way they come together, that sense of doing it over without actually doing it over, because that ended in divorce. So there's that. And these children who have lost everything and need to be brought back so they can do over their childhood. So I think there's going to be something there. But for the most part, this book is still in the place where you're kind of casting around, you're trying to see what's there or what isn't. And at the same time, I have to set up the ghosts. I think the 19th century was a lot more open about ghosts, about they just assumed they were there. We have to, in the 20th century, we're much more analytical. We had parapsychologists. So I brought in the parapsychologists so that, at first, so that Emmy would have somebody sit down and say, okay, I think I have ghosts, you know, like rats. How do I get rid of them? And that the parapsychologist, who actually does not believe in ghosts, would sit down and say, well, here's the five kinds, and here's how this works, and I think you have this. So I was working with all the modern things that I had to do to make it work for a modern audience and still pulling on all the stuff from Henry James. And it's like a great writing exercise. A great writing exercise is when you look at it and think, why do I have to do all this stuff? And then by doing all that stuff, pulling all that stuff together, you get something really fascinating because you've had those boundaries. The best writing exercise I've ever had was one that a teacher at Ohio State gave me. Ron Carlson, he was the visiting author. He was fabulous. But he came in and he said, you're going to write a story. It has 26 sentences. The first one begins with A. The second one begins with B. The third one begins with C. And I looked at him and thought, I'm a published author. You know, why are you doing this? But, you know, it was Ron Carlson. He was brilliant. So I did it. It was the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. The best stories we ever wrote in that class came out of that exercise. And I wrote one called The Day My Sister Shot the Mailman and Got Away with It, Of Course. And I revised it into a short story, but it actually became the foundation for a novel I wrote called Crazy for You about two sisters in their 30s. This was when they were, Quinn was 15 and I think Zoe was 18. And it gave me all the background. I thought, I need to know about these people, but I don't know, I'm a teenager, so we're gonna move it up. So at this part, I could keep reading, but you know, that's kind of boring. So I think what we should do is go to questions. If you don't have any questions, I'll have to read, so that's a threat. You don't ask questions, you get me reading. Who's got a question? Yes. The first scene, where is it set? You know, that's an interesting question, because I did have it in Boston, and that they were going to have to fly to Southern Ohio, and I decided I'm moving it here. I did decide, that's not pandering to you, I really did decide I was going to move it to Columbus. I wanted it far enough away from Southern Ohio that it would take them a while to get there, but that they, you know, they could see something on TV and drive down. So he's a lawyer here in Columbus, and if any of you know a lawyer in Columbus, let me know, because I don't know anything about that. You're a lawyer in Columbus?
No.
We must speak. Your son's a lawyer? Great. Is he cute? You know, Bob's gone now. I'm not, what? His wife as well? Okay, never mind. I don't do that. Who else has a question? Yes?
I want to know who you read.
Who I read?
Popular authors now.
Lately, I have been just writing 24/7. There's so much writing to do. But when I need a fiction break, you know, my comfort author, the one I go to, it's Terry Pratchett. I love the Discworld. And they're so brilliant. They, you know, if you look at them, they've got these comic covers, and they look like, you know, throwaway science fiction or whatever. But read The Truth, which is about the first newspaper in Ankh-Morpork. Or my first one was Feet of Clay. It's brilliant. It is brilliant satire. It's incredibly funny, beautiful writing, first person. Terry Pratchett, totally recommend him. My favorite, Terry Pratchett. Pratchett, P-R-A-T-C-H-E-T-T. And for my favorite all-time romance is actually the Grand Sophie by Georgette Heyer. I think she wrote it in the 40s. But I loved it so much, I wrote a book called Welcome to Temptation, and I named my heroine Sophie because I love the Grand Sophie so much. But other than that, I read, it's hard for me to say, oh yeah, I read this current, because the romance novel is very close. And if I mention one, they'll go, yeah, what about me? So I tend not to mention anybody, but there are a lot of people. You know, Ann Stewart, Lonnie Diane Rich, Patricia Gaffney, Susan Elizabeth Phillips is fabulous. But it's hard for me because I know them all. We're all real close. And so you don't tend to look at a book and go, you know, this isn't really very good when you know how hard somebody worked on it. But they really are good. They're good. You're safe.
Why are you close?
Why am I close?
I mean, why are this group of you, where are you? You're close.
The romance community is like nothing else you've ever seen. We don't compete. Our philosophy is that nobody ever read a great romance, finished it, and said, well, I don't need to read any more of these. So the more good romance writers you have, romance readers are inveterate readers. I mean, they read like no other group in the world. They spend, before this thing hit, they spent $1,500 a month on books. They read like crazy. It is not unusual for a romance reader to read a book, you know, 5 or 6 books a week. They love reading, they love the genre, and they are very involved in it. Plus, they are very internet savvy. So there's a lot of back and forth on the internet. I have a blog. People come on there and ask me questions. The blog is not, I'm not telling you to go to the blog because it's not well organized. The last one thing I blogged about was how I didn't have any makeup to go for this thing. So everybody came on and said, oh, you should use this makeup. It was very helpful. So, I mean, you know, it's not a literary blog. Don't go there. And I think the one before that was a rant about my copy editor on Wild Ride because I was really annoyed with her. So it's, you know, it's not high class. But we also meet then at there are book signings and things like that. People come out. They have romance reader communities on the net where everybody, and you go there and talk. It's I've never seen anything like it, that the community is that close. And then we all go, once a year we go to the writers, go to Romance Writers of America, the national conference. And most of us go just to schmooze because it's the only time we see each other. The rest of the time we're on the net. But that's really wonderful. That's a big party. And we all get together and we talk about publishing and we help each other out. It's RWA in particular educates. I know it sounds like a commercial, but they explain to romance writers about what publishing is and where the pitfalls are and where you're going to get ripped off. And here, you know, hook up and we do a lot of mentoring, a lot of teaching and a lot of mentoring. It's just a really great community. So we don't tend to say, you know, I really love her, she's darling, but geez, her books suck. Just don't mention them. There are very few men, and most of them write under a female pseudonym. I mean, we're more than willing to take them in, but it's getting broader and broader and relaxing. But I think there's really intrinsically a difference in the way that men fantasize about romance and women fantasize about romance. There's just a different vibe to it. So a lot of the things that you might consider romances that men are writing are really love stories, because the basic definition of a romance is a story about a relationship between two people who love each other that ends optimistically. That romances are intrinsically optimistic about emotional justice in the universe. We believe that if you take a risk and extend that emotional, take that emotional risk, that you'll be rewarded, which does not mean throwing a bottle in the water and drowning. That's not a reward. I always thought maybe his ex-wife was out there in the water, you know, the ghost saying, you cheated on me, get over here. But yes. If you were watching me write, describe the room I'm writing in and what I'm wearing. This is where it gets X-rated. Up until a couple weeks ago, I was living alone, so I could basically, you know, there was a lot of time it was the underwear and a t-shirt. Now I've got 2 little girls living with me, and, you know, I want to set a good example, so it's like jeans and a t-shirt. Still no bra, because what's the point? But I live in a big house on the river. I bought it not because it was a big house, but because it was on the river, and it was the one that was in my budget, but it's huge and ugly, but it has a lot of room, so I can move from room to room. So like a lot of the times I write on the bed, I write on my laptop most of the time. I do have an office that right now is so full of junk I can't get to the desk. I have a lot of lazy boys. I'm a big lazy boy fan, because if you put a pillow or a lap desk on your lap and put the lap desk and then lean back, there are no pressure points. You sit at a desk, you know, you start to twitch. But this way, the lazy boy is excellent. So I have several lazy boys scattered around the house. And then I also have a patio that's on the river that I can go down there. So basically, I write until I get stuck, and then I pick it up someplace else. And a lot of the times, it's just staring into space. You're not even writing. You're just moving stuff around, and you really need to, if you're a writer, you really need to live with another writer, because they go, what are you doing? And it's like, I had it, and you talked to me. You see that glazed look, go away, I'm working. So, you know, a lot of times it's just going someplace where nobody else is. But it's not exciting, and no, I don't write to a schedule. Somebody like, shh, me? You should know me better than that by now. Yes? No, I'm not up at 8 in the morning. She asked if I wrote on a regular schedule, like from 8 to 12. First of all, I write until about 4 in the morning because it's really quiet there. I think there's actually something about there's less noise in the air, maybe radio waves or something. I'm not scientific, but it's very, very quiet, especially where I am. It's literally the middle of the wilderness. So I write, and also New York never calls at 4 o'clock in the morning, so that's good. Write until about 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I sleep till 11 or noon, and then I get up, and while I'm up during the day, that's when I deal with New York or answer the emails or whatever. And then when the sun goes down and everything's quiet, then I go back to work. But that is not every day. I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the book, and I get really nervous because I'm not writing, and it feels, you know, that Puritan work ethic. Unless I'm hitting those keys, as George Booth would say, I'm not really writing. But you have to go through this if you try to rush it. And then you'll write and look at something and think, no, that's not right, and sit back and stare into space again. So it's a very amorphous process. I don't have... Now, if that discourages you, I will tell you that Nora Roberts starts at 8 in the morning and goes till 5 o'clock and won't even see her grandchildren. She starts at 8, goes to 5 every damn day, except for the weekends. Then she takes the weekends off. So there are people who do it right. I'm just not one of them. I had a very authoritative mother. So once I left at 17, I thought, I'm never doing anything on a schedule again. Anybody else? Yes. Why did I choose to write romance? I didn't actually choose to become a writer. I loved being a teacher, and my first degree was in art. So my first career choice was actually, yes, this is true, it was the 60s, I went into weaving. I still have the looms, don't laugh. Weaving is really cool, it's very relaxing. I do a lot of crochet now. And then I taught art for a long time. And I went back to school, because anybody here who's a teacher knows that if you take an extra 15 hours, you go up a pay step. And I had like an extra class to take. And at that point, you go back in the summer, you take whatever looks interesting. And there was a class on feminist literature. And I went to Mary Beth Pringle's class on feminist literature at Wright State University. And it just radicalized me. Up until then, I was basically a feminist, but I didn't know it. You know, and I didn't have that focus. And I didn't have, so I started reading this fabulous literature, and Mary Beth was wonderful. And I came out of thought and thought, wait a minute, there's a whole world out there. And that's when I got my master's in literature. Still not going to be a writer. I was an academic. I was a good academic, too. My criticism rocked. And then kind of followed my nose to Ohio State, and it was fabulous there. They let me into the PhD program, biggest miracle of my life. And I was researching my dissertation, which was going to be on the differences between, after this speech, no surprise, the differences in the way men and women structure stories. Because I knew anecdotally from the way women told stories, like sitting on the front porch, and the way men told stories, there was a vast difference, because men start at the beginning, tell you what happened next, tell you what happened next, and tell you what the results are. They're very organized. And women will sit down and go, so I saw Susie at the market. You remember Susie? She was the sister of that woman who died the year the apple butter went bad. And you know, we may never get to the end of the story. But we don't care. Because what we're interested in is the people and the, you know, the wallpaper and the stuff that happened. We're interested in character. It's the reason, by the way, I think that, you know, there's the old thing, women can't tell jokes. It's because we don't care about getting to the end. You know, men will tell jokes like the one about the farmer's daughter. There's a salesman. What's he selling? I don't know what he's selling. He's a salesman. He's selling Bibles. And he stops by this farm, and there's a farmer's daughter. How old is she? I don't know how old is she. What difference does it make? Well, if she's 16 and innocent, or, you know, 30 and bitter, I need to know. So, you know, at this point, guys are tearing their hair out because we're ruining the joke. We really are. But on the other hand, he just wants to get to the end, and all the good stuff he's missing. So I'm looking at the ways, different ways men and women tell jokes and the ways that men and women tell stories, and I realized that in order to be published, women have to write in a foreign language, because you have to start at the beginning and go on until you get at the end. There are very few writers, I think if you read Carrie Fisher's Postcards from the Edge, and of course literary writers often break structure, but if you're talking about popular fiction, you're using a male structure. And my thesis was that women were writing in a foreign language, and that the genre probably that I was going to see the most leeway here would be romance fiction, because it was written by women, edited by women, and read by women. So 1 month, I was single mother in grad school, incredibly depressed. In the middle of summer, I thought, I'm just going to do this. I bought 100 romance novels and read them in 1 month. And of course, I read them as an academic, so I'm analyzing them. You know, the first kiss is here, and here's this, and are they doing this? And someplace in there, I lost my grip and just started to read them. And what I realized was that I was reading stories in which a woman had a problem, she struggled, and she won. She had a problem, she struggled, and she won. She had a problem, she struggled, and she won. Over and over and over and over, 100 times in 1 month. Now, of course, I was an 18th century British scholar, so a 19th century scholar. So I was reading, British and American, I went both ways. And so I was reading about, you know, Hester Prynne, who has one bout of glorious sex in her life and spends the rest of her life apologizing for it. Really sorry I did that. Or Madame Bovary, who is the only person in the history of the world to take a week to die of arsenic poisoning because she had sex. You know, you go, and of course, romance novels, they were having all kinds of sex and not dying, which was really radical. And I realized that as much as I love this literature, I kept getting this message, which I don't think was accidental, by the way. As a feminist, I'd like to point out, there were a lot of guys writing that one. You have sex, you die, unless you have it with me, in which case. So I went back to that and thought, okay, something radical is happening here. There is something, you know, people are always saying, romance novels are so badly written, why are they so popular? And I hadn't quite gotten to the point where, what do you mean they're all badly written? I kept thinking, I know why they're so popular. This is the only thing, this is like the antitoxin to the 20th century. And so I moved my thesis to romance fiction and thought, you know, in order to totally understand this, I know what happens when I read it, and I want to know what happens when I write it. And honestly, I think deep down inside, I just wanted to write it. But I didn't believe I could be a writer. And I remember the first day I finished my first novel. People always say, what's the best moment of your career? Was it the New York Times? Was it? No, it was when I finished that novel. It was a horrible novel, by the way. It was 160,000 words. I had no clue. But I finished it, and I printed it out, and I saw it on the desk, and I thought, my God, I can do this. Up until then, the people who wrote novels were, you know, they'd been lumberjacks or something, you know, they'd been had wonderful lives, and they were so much smarter than I were, and most of them were men. This was not something I could do. And I wrote that novel, looked at it, and thought, I can do this. I mean, I sat there and cried. And later on, it did sell after it was cut by half, and it became my first novel for Harlequin. But it was just, it was such a revelation. And then you kind of get hooked on it. You know, there's stories you have to tell. And because I am such a wonk, because I had done so much literature, so I kept thinking the structure is beautiful. And I started looking at the bones. So you have the stuff on top, which is the fun stuff, where you're writing the stuff and it's coming up and people are being clever and all this. And then you look underneath it and they're the beautiful bones of this fiction. If you can just get it, it's so hard, but if you can just rearrange this, if you can just cut the words, if you can just make the words right, if you can just get it so that the bones are right, then people can go ahead and read the stuff on the surface and say, this was so funny, it was so much fun, or whatever, but the bones will be there, and the meaning will be there, and it'll stay with them, and when they go back the next time, they'll see a new book, and it's just, it was like the best thing ever. It was just wonderful, and I got hooked on it, and I've been doing it ever since. So that was a long answer. Sorry. Yes. What advice would I give to somebody who's interested in writing? The first thing is read. People come up to me, I know it's not you, I'm not talking about you, but I've had people come up to me at book signings and say, I really want to write, and I say, what do you read? And they say, oh, we don't read, you know, I don't, I just want to write a book. They don't want to write, they want to have written. I really like this, you sit up here at the table and you sign books and people are nice to you. How can I get that job? Well, first of all, probably unless you've been reading since you were two, you're not going to get the job. And then if you're writing to get published, you're probably not going to get the job, because people who write in order to be published, instead of in order to tell the stories, don't tell very good stories. It's all about them. It's not, you have to love story. And you have to think, I think, although there are any number of writers who will disagree, please remember this is, you know, I'm not responsible for this, it's just my personal opinion. I think you have to love your reader. The first draft is for you. You can do anything you want in that. You can be as selfish as you want. But the minute you hand it to anybody to read, including your best friend, to just, you know, just take a look at this, you are taking part of their lives. If you're selling the book, you're taking part of their money, too. And in this economy, that's big. I do not undercut. But the big thing is, if you're going to read one of my books, you're going to lose 3 or 4 hours of your life. What am I giving you back in return? And how am I making this book part of your story? Am I giving you enough room in this book to move in and make this story yours? Because nobody ever reads the same book. Every reader brings something of his or her own to the book. And the more space you leave in there, the more room you leave for that reader to move in there and expand while you guide her in this story, the better that experience is. So I think you have to look at why you want to write, first of all. First of all, you have to be a huge reader, because that's how you learn the rhythms and really the structure, how you internalize it. And then you have to, I think, really want to tell stories. What I always tell people who say, you know, If God came to you today and said, you will never be published, it's a fact, you are never going to get published, would you still write that story? And if you'd say, yes, I still have to write the story, then you're a writer, it's going to be okay. Believe it or not, I think you'll get published. But it's people who, and I understand that, who think if I just get published, then I'll be somebody, who are taking their identity from being published. All that stuff gets in the way of you accessing your story. I firmly believe that every story you will ever write is already present in your subconscious. And the reason you have to write it is because you're the kind of person that it bubbles to the top and you have to do something about it. So the biggest thing you have to do as a writer, once you've done all your reading, and I think Lee K. Abbott revolutionized my writing when I took his classes at Ohio State. I never underestimate what that man did for me. But in the end, it has to be those stories you have to access. And anything that gets in the way, such as worrying about whether it's going to be published, worrying about whether it's at the right market, worrying about, is it a mystery or a romance? Gee, I don't know. It doesn't matter. All that matters is you've got the story you have to tell, and you get out of the way. And then once it's out there, then you can turn into a publisher and try to sell it and so on. But the big thing is, read everything you can get your hands on. And I mean everything. Screenplays, comic books. You know, if you're the kind of person who's stuck without reading material, so you start reading the Campbell's Soup label, you know who you are out there. That's when you know that you're really hooked on this, that you're a junkie for words. And then needing to communicate this story to an audience, needing to connect with somebody, that this is not a mirror you're holding up to yourself or something that you're trying to establish your identity, that you really need to reach that audience and connect. And then you start working on your craft and it really comes down to, do you have a story you have to tell? Because if you have to, you have to tell it anyway, so go ahead and tell it, and then there you are. That was garbled. Yes, Linda? Have I always had a humorous bent to my stories? I actually don't write comedy. I think the minute you think, oh, this is going to be funny, is when you jump the shark. But what I tend to do is write the kind of people that I would like to spend time with, because if the reader doesn't want to spend time with them, let's face it, the book's over. And the people I like to spend time with tend to use humor as a coping mechanism. And therefore, the humor, I don't think I've, somebody said once, you have such great one-liners, and I said, name one. You can't pull a one-liner out of them, they don't make jokes. It's in the interactions and what, I always said the funniest line I ever wrote was, oh look, you hired a shepherd. If you know that book, it's hysterical. If you don't, it's like, uh-huh. It has to come from character. And I think people, you know, when people list the things they want in a mate, the top five things, sense of humor is always in there. And it's because people who can cope with adversity with a sense of humor when it's appropriate are very mentally healthy or stable. They can pull back and they can see the humor in a situation. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so enticing and why I write people like that. The other thing is, though, humor is incredibly subjective, and not everybody thinks I'm funny, which is fine. I'm not sure I'm funny either, but you know, you can't sit down and go, I'm going to make the whole world laugh. No, you're not. It's impossible. Tragedy, I think, is universal. You know, you kill a kitten, you got 99% of the people going, oh, that's terrible, but the laugh is a lot harder. I learned this the hard way. I was used to be in grad school at Ohio State. At the time, the creative writing department was almost all male. And I was in a bar late at night, sitting at this table with seven or eight guys. I don't remember, because, you know, we were all bitching about the program or whatever. What you do in grad school? And they started telling jokes. And most of them were kind of anti-feminist. I said, I have a joke, because I love my joke. This is my favorite joke, if I can remember how to tell it. Two little kids playing in a sandbox. Don't stop me if you've heard it, because I love this joke. Two little kids, little boy, little girl. The little boy says, we have a big boat. Little girl says, oh, we have a big boat. Little boy says, we have a big house. Little girl says, oh, we have a big house. Little boy looks at her and thinks, competitive bitch. He stands up, he takes down his pants, and he says, I have one of these. Little girl stands up, takes down her pants, looks down, and runs screaming home to her mother. The next day, the little girl is back in the sandbox, because we always go back, don't we? Little boy says, we have a big dog. Little girl says, oh, we have a big dog. Little boy says, well, we have a big car. Little girl says, we have a big car. Little boy thinks, this woman never learns. Stands up, takes down his pants, he says, I have one of these. The little girl looks at it and goes, oh yeah, my mom says when I grow up, I'm gonna have all of those I want. Now, the thing about this joke, men don't laugh at it. Everything you needed to know about subjective humor is right there. 2 minutes? Huh? Two more questions. Anne runs my life. Yes. The journey from when I finished my first novel to it being published. Well, I sent it everywhere and was rejected everywhere. If you're bad with rejection, don't become a writer. Because even after you're published, people are going to be spitting on you. Reviewers hate you. It just never ends. You just have to be. I never actually thought about it, you know, developed a strategy, but in case you haven't noticed, I have a very healthy ego. So every time somebody rejected, I thought, well, she's wrong, and sent it out again. You know, if you start taking it personally, obviously. And one of the nice things was, when we were shopping my first hardcover, my agent sent it out to 9 people, everybody rejected it. I've gotten more rejections, sweetie. And then later, Jen Enderlin took it to St. Martin's and made it, you know, it was a real big hit. And one of the authors who had rejected, or one of the editors who rejected it, came up to my agent and said, I love that book, why didn't you send it to me? And Meg said, you rejected it. And she said, the editor turned sheet white and said, don't ever tell anybody at my publishing house that. And I thought, yes, yes. You dumb bitch, you should have bought it. Actually, I ended up with Jennifer Enderlin, St. Martin's Press. If you can ever write for Jennifer Enderlin, she's a goddess. She really is amazing. There are a lot of people who aren't goddesses out there, but Jennifer Enderlin is the best. So we sent it, it was the 160,000 word extravaganza. And actually what I had done was I couldn't get anybody to buy this book. And Harlequin had a contest where if you wrote a novella, 2,500 words, that they would publish that. And I thought, I had this book. The first book I started, I was trying to write a romance. I hate people who do air quotes, but this was a romance. So she was like 23 and the CEO of her company and incredibly gorgeous. And he was, I mean, I stopped about 10,000 words into it and thought, I would not have lunch with these people. Why am I writing a novel about them? But I still had the 10,000 words, and there was some snappy patter in there. So I thought, okay, I'll slap another 50. I'll put an ending on this, and I'll send it off. And they won't buy this because it's terrible. But they'll say, do you have anything else? Because your snappy patter is good. And I will send them this book, and they will go, oh, my God, and I'll be, you know, big dreams. So, of course, you know what happened. They published the horrible novella and rejected my book. So now I was actually 2 steps back because the only thing I had in print was this. It's horrible. It's truly, really horrible. Nobody, it's the only book of mine nobody's ever reissued, and I'm praying nobody ever does, so I don't mention it to my publisher. But I can't tell you how bad this book is. It's like, you know when actresses start out and they do a porn film and then it haunts them? This is my porn film. Which, by the way, the last time I checked was selling for $70 on eBay. So I'm not going to tell you the title of it. But what happened was the editor who rejected it said, you know, there's some really good parts in this. And she sent it to a book doctor at Harlequin, an editor who was known. And the editor called me up and said, I love this book. But, you know, first of all, it's 160,000 words. And it had started out as this comedy. And then halfway through, I got depressed. And there was a divorce and a date rape. And she said, you have a tone problem. So if you cut the last, 100,000 words of this book and let me help you, and she guided me through it, and that's how I was published. And then I started the next one and realized I knew nothing about writing fiction. I had all these degrees in literature, and I thought that should do it. But I found out the difference in writing criticism of fiction and actually writing fiction is the difference in sitting up in the stands and saying, you know, she wobbled on that triple axel and going down on the ice and hitting the triple axel. It's a whole new ball game. So I took a course from Michael Haig in screenwriting. It was either the electric bill or the course. And I thought, eh, candles. And went to this, and that gave me the beginnings of structure. And I wrote a couple more books and ended up at Wright State where Lee K. Abbott grabbed me by the throat and said, I understand you're published. You should be in my class. And I was so terrified. I knew everybody was going to laugh at me because I was a romance writer. So I audited it, and it changed my life. He is the most amazing teacher. And the people in that class, all they cared about was fiction. All they cared about was writing story. They didn't give a damn what I was writing. All they cared about was the words. And it just, I went right into the MFA program there, and the Ohio MFA writing program changed everything. Usually there's not much of a connection between publishing and academe. But I was working on a book called What the Lady Wants. That wasn't my title, by the way. I hate that title, but, you know, I didn't have any power then. And it was done, and I took Lee's class, and I called my editor. I said, I'm taking this class right now. I really want another shot at this book. I'm learning stuff. Can I have another 3 months? Because that would have been the quarter. And she said, yes. And I rewrote the book. Every day I'd go into Lee's class and I'd learn this stuff and then go back and look at the book and think, no, it's got to be this way. It was so incredibly exciting. I can't tell you. I get goosebumps when I think about it now. It was like there was this thing I wanted to do and there was this guy who could show me how to do it. It was the best educational experience of my life. And at the end, I sent the book to my editor. And she called and she said, I don't know what you're doing, but you keep doing it. And that was the first time I thought, okay, this is, I got something here. This is, if I can just get this, if I can just, and the thing is, you never do. You never stop learning. You learn something with every book, and you can never sit back and go, okay, I know this. Every time, it's really hard, but it's fabulous. You're creating this world, and then you're sending out to people you'll never meet, and they get to move into that world and make the story theirs, and it's just the best thing in the world. I can't tell you. I'm sorry, I kind of lose my grip on this, but it's so great. And then you go to Thurber House and they feed you. I mean, there's no downside here. Yeah. I would go back to OSU like a shot. I'm not sure OSU wants me, to tell you the truth, but I loved OSU. I love teaching there. The English department is fabulous. They do classes here at Thurber House, and I had dinner with Suzanne last night, and she said, we're thinking about a master class where somebody would come in for the day, and I said, oh, that sounds nice, and she said, would you do it? I said, oh, yeah. You know, I was sitting there hoping, master class. I said, ask me. And she said, would you do it? So I don't know when it's going to be set up, but I'll definitely do, anytime Thurber House calls, I'm there. But a master class would be fun. And I don't actually know what a master class is, but it's teaching writing and it's here. So I'm, don't ask me details. I just said, yes, I'll teach anywhere. But I know this is like talking to the hometown crowd, but I love this city. So I love living where I am now, but I come back to Columbus. We drove all over it today because I had to do media. And I just think, oh, I remember that. And then it's so changed. I mean, it's, the stuff is gorgeous. Although I do miss, like me and Mr. Mustard, that was a real loss. But you know, it's such a gorgeous city, and it's such a friendly city, and it's so warm, and there's so much stuff here, and I love coming back here. Every time I come back here, I think, oh, I should have stayed. Get a little house next to the university, be an academic, and then I remember what a bad academic I was. So, but yes. Yeah, and Anne would like me to stop now. Thank you so much for coming out.